Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, May 24th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. The line just got shorter, but you probably didn't notice it. At your airport security checkpoint, they pulled somebody out of the line yesterday. The Transportation Security Administration replaced its top security official, blamed for all the long lines, Kelly Hogan, who had been the assistant administrator for the Office of Security Operations. But the wait times signify care in screening passengers, right? 3 hours in Chicago? Waits at New York's JFK Airport up 80% from last year. Many airports are trying to deal with this by hiring private security contractors to make up for a 10% decrease in employees since 2013, even though air travel is up some 12%. How much of the troubles at the TSA signify that the whole approach to aviation security has not kept up with changing technology, the changing nature of threats, or the realistic probabilities that an airplane will be a target, even given the Egypt Air disaster investigators are looking at this week? Bruce Schneier, a security technologist and author, says a whole new approach is in order.
Firings seem to be based on the fact that there are a lot of complaints and heads need to roll. Whether this will be changes or not remains to be seen. I mean, we're really just reading tea leaves at this point. So it's really hard for me to see what's going to happen. I think we do need some changes, and we'll see if Congress is willing to make them, if the TSA is willing to make them.
What about this front-end security and the way the United States has dealt with it in airline safety?
You know, it's a good question, and we want to separate two things here. One is whether the TSA is doing things right, and that has to do with the lines and the checkpoints and who's where and the staffing. And the other is what you asked, are they doing the right things? I think it's a real conversation to have, whether airport security is effective, what sorts of security we need in our country. But it's a very different sort of conversation and a hard one for us to have. My feeling is the TSA hasn't been doing the right things for a long time. Doing things right is really a matter of budget, and their budget's been cut. So we really have both problems to deal with, and they're very separate.
Given that the changes in the protocols there at the airport have been determined by, in many cases, you know, crimes that were about to be committed, the shoe bomber, and then now everyone's taking their shoes off, the bomb assembly that was being done in Denver and was on its way to some airport somewhere, and they caught it in time, thank God. But that forced a change in everybody having to get rid of their liquids. Are you confident that the TSA is anticipating what's going to happen as opposed to waiting until something almost does?
Of course not. And that litany is an example of that. There's a shoe bomber, we take off our shoes. Liquid bomber, we screen liquids. Underwear bomber, we have full body scanners. I mean, all of those things are reactive. And that's why it doesn't really work. The goal isn't to protect what the terrorists did last week, but to anticipate what they do next week. And the liquid bomber is a good example of that, because they were caught in London in their apartments before they got to the airport. They picked a plot designed to get through airport security. And they were caught through investigation intelligence having nothing to do with airport security. And that's really where we have our successes in this country too. You know, we don't catch stuff at airports. Airport security is the last line of defense and not a very good one. The best things we do are the things that don't try to guess the plot, the tactic, the target correctly.
What is the biggest security vulnerability at an airport? Is it at the front end, or is it somewhere else?
You know, that's a really hard question to answer, because you don't care about the biggest. You care what are the vulnerabilities. I mean, if you are a bomber, what you want is a lot of people packed tightly together. And they exist just as much inside the airport as outside the airport on the security lines. I mean, we don't want bombs to get on airplanes because they have a special failure mode. Right? A small bomb takes down the plane, everyone dies. But if you think of all the places where people gather together packed relatively tightly, shopping malls, supermarkets, stadiums, theaters, we can just go on and on and on. You can't possibly ever protect them all. Even a country like Israel can't. So you just have to do the difference that makes airplanes more attractive targets. And then you have to realize that you're going to have to stop these people before they get to the location. You know, I'm in Boston right now, the finish line of the Boston Marathon, another place where people were packed tightly together that we never even thought of before.
And again, the response reactive. I guess I'm wondering if any of these soft targets of transportation facilities are, you know, adequately being looked at, and that the TSA is a holdover from 9/11 that was really, really important at one moment, but maybe has evolved past its usefulness in the way that we really, really need for the future.
I mean, that's largely true. The TSA was a reaction to the tactic of the moment. And while I don't say abolish the TSA, I think we should ratchet airport security back down to pre-9/11 levels. I mean, a lot of tests have shown that the TSA misses 70% of guns, 80%, I mean, crazy numbers. And you look at that and you say, wow, the TSA isn't really good at detecting these things. But then you have to say, well, then why aren't planes falling out of the sky? And the reason is there's nothing to detect. There aren't these terrorists coming through with guns and bombs, and our only defense is the TSA. It turns out there are almost no terrorists. Most of them are kind of dumb, and they're not doing these sorts of plots. So while we need airport security, I think we do need to back off and look at what the actual threats are these days.
How do you back off without eliminating the TSA and terrifying everyone, making them full of anxiety going to the airport?
Well, this is actually hard because it's not just the anxiety of the people. It's the anxiety of the elected officials. If you are Congress and you say, well, we don't need this, we're going to reduce the security requirements, we're going to go back down to pre-9/11 levels of security, and you get it wrong, you're out of job. It is always in the best interest to exaggerate the threats. So we're kind of stuck in a loop. We have to back off slowly, and you see us doing that somewhat with PreCheck. You know, PreCheck is very much pre-9/11 security if you're on the list. We're seeing much fewer liquid detections. Those rules are kind of backing off. You know, shoes are still being screened, but not as much. So slowly it's happening, but this is very difficult because, you're right, people might get anxious, and elected officials are scared for their careers if they make the wrong guess.
Is this a money problem that can be solved with increased funds, like, for instance, $7.6 billion that the president wants to give to the TSA for next year?
So certainly the doing things right problem can. Now, we've been discussing, are we doing the right things? But the doing things right, the lines at the airport, the delays, that is 100% caused by not enough money for agents and lines. We increase their budget, we will have fewer delays at the airport. You know, it's not going to solve what we're talking about, but it will make all of our experiences better when we get to the airport.
So shorter lines has nothing to do with security?
It doesn't. They're different criteria, right? The shortness of the line is how many people can a checkpoint process per hour. Security is what they're doing. Now, certainly, if we backed off on requirements, we might get through faster. But, you know, you look at it, you look at airport security checkpoints, people go through pretty fast. I don't think it really is we need to move people through a particular line faster. We need more lines.
What's a Schneier airport check? If I were to come to, you know, Schneier International Airport, what would get checked on me?
So we would send you through a magnetometer, because you might be carrying something, and will screen your luggage. Now, airport security catches the baseline terrorist, the one who's going to do something stupid. And we need to catch those people. The experts, like the liquid bomber or the underwear bomber, they're going to do things that are designed to get through airport security. I need to catch them some other way. I'm not going to get them at the airport. So redesign airport security to catch, you know, the random nut jobs, and then we'll be doing well.
Comfortable flyer, Bruce?
I think so. I have no trouble, but certainly we need to actually tell people what the risks are. We've spent a decade and a half convincing people they need to be scared of terrorism, you know, which kills so few people that if it wasn't for all the hype, we would never think about worrying about it. And again, this is hard because we've built domestic policies and foreign policies, and there's a lot of money in overhyping this threat.
Bruce Schneier rhymes with, what did you say?
Frequent flyer.
There you go. Security technologist and author. Thanks so much, Bruce.
Thank you.
Over the past century, our two nations have known cooperation and then conflict, painful separation, and a long reconciliation.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear.
Now, more than two decades of normalized ties between our governments allows us to reach a new moment.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
It's clear from this visit that both our peoples are eager for an even closer relationship, a deeper relationship.
That is a ride through space and history in sound. From a pop tune on the streets of Saigon in 1968 to a pop tune on the streets of the USA in 1970, to President Obama this week in Hanoi, where people cheered when he ordered lunch. But the official reconciliation between the U.S. and Vietnam seems to be the easy part. There is money to be made, and regional politics driving a U.S. alliance with Vietnam. It is deeper, where the war still is waged in memory, both in the United States and in Vietnam. The book The Sympathizer by Viet Thanh Nguyen is the winner of this year's Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. Nguyen grew up in a country divided. His parents fled to South Vietnam in the mid-1950s and then to the U.S. in 1975 when the South fell to the North. Nguyen says to some people he will always be a man from South Vietnam.
I think there are many people in Vietnam and the United States for whom the war hasn't truly ended. They still carry an emotional residue with them of trauma or maybe something a little bit less. But those aren't really the voices that are going to be asked about their opinions on what President Obama's visit signifies for Vietnam and for the United States. So they'll remain quiet and in the shadows, which they're unfortunately used to.
Have you noticed in the United States that there is a kind of shadow Vietnam War still going on among people who were sympathizers for the cause and sympathizers for the protest movement that helped to end the war in the 1960s and 70s?
I think that everybody who had passionate feelings about the war, whether they fought in the war, supported the war, were against the war, left the country, or have been refugees fleeing from Southeast Asia to come to the United States, still think about this war quite a bit, and still, when the issue of the war comes up, are ready to resurrect these old feelings and fight these old battles. I hear from them quite often when I'm out on the lecture circuit or when I post things on social media or write articles. The same arguments that they had carried out 40 years ago are still the same arguments they're putting forth today.
Why do you think it's the case that the U.S. and Vietnam seem to be so cordial and ready to move on, but within each country, there's really not that same kind of inclination that, as you say, the shadow wars go on?
Well, genuine peace and reconciliation between individuals and inside of individuals is really difficult to achieve. I mean, that calls for a kind of spiritual reclamation, a kind of confrontation and dialogue with the people with whom one has been opposed. But peace and reconciliation carried out at the level of states, which is what we're seeing here between Vietnam and the United States, oftentimes tends to be much more pragmatic and done in the interests of leaders, governments, military industrial complexes, rather than necessarily in response to citizens or the population. And one of the ways by which this has become easier for these two countries is that, at least in the case of Vietnam, the greater threat is perceived to be China. The U.S. intervention in Vietnam, the Vietnam War, or what the victorious Vietnamese called the American War, even though that was a 30-year conflict and even though it was a civil war in the American soul, for the Vietnamese, it tends to be seen as simply one episode in a much longer history of colonization and war. and the history of the conflict with China, you know, in terms of China occupying the Vietnam for 1,000 years, is still very much in Vietnamese minds, and China remains the neighbor, the big threatening neighbor that they have to deal with on a daily basis. And the U.S. has now gone from being an enemy to being someone or some country that can be used as an ally to help negotiate this relationship with China.
Are you patriotic?
I'm patriotic in the sense that I believe that all countries have great ideals that they have set for themselves, and that these ideals are oftentimes very noble and that we should aspire to them. Things like freedom and democracy and independence, which both Vietnam and the United States espouse. But these ideals are often ruined in practice, or at least deeply compromised by governments, by nation states, by militaries. And so I draw a clear distinction between what it means to be a patriot and what it means to be someone who is doing what their country or their state tells them to do.
What is your country?
In my book, Nothing Ever Dies, I talk about how there are nations and then how there is an imagination that goes beyond the nation. And that is something that is espoused oftentimes by artists, by activists, by religious and spiritual leaders. And that's my country, the imagination. I think that that's where we need to think. That's where we need to go. We need to think about how we can't resign ourselves to the present. If we look back to the past and we see that our ancestors, for them, the reality was the tribe or the city-state, and anybody outside of those boundaries was the enemy. Well, now, thousands of years later, we've expanded to the nation state, and we've consigned ourselves, so many of us, to thinking that the nation state's borders are the ultimate reality. But for me, we really need to dream beyond that, to think about how the imagination can take us across national borders and to bring us into conversations, to dialogues with people who have, you know, we might have once considered to be enemies.
Viet Thanh Nguyen, thank you so much.
Thank you for your time.
Viet Thanh Nguyen is a professor at the University of Southern California. He's also the author of Nothing Ever Dies, Vietnam and the Memory of War, and The Sympathizer, which won this year's Pulitzer Prize for fiction. A judge's verdict in the death of Freddie Gray this week acquitted Officer Edward Nero on 4 misdemeanor charges. An earlier trial of one of the 6 charged officers ended in a hung jury. Now, 4 more police officers are set to stand trial, and the next hearing, set for early June, could be a stronger case for conviction. The attorney for the family of Freddie Gray has urged the community to think and read before they act.
Hopefully, people who are in the mood to protest his decision, who have not yet read his excellent opinion, will do that first, and then make a decision about whether or not they thought the outcome was fair. And I'll make a prediction. If you can read, you'll be satisfied.
That's attorney Billy Murphy, Jr. Mark Steiner is president and executive producer of the Center for Emerging Media and host of The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA-FM in Baltimore. Welcome, Mark.
Pleasure to be back.
Do people understand what was at stake for the prosecutors?
They do, but the common wisdom is that Freddie Gray was hurt before he got in the van because he was screaming at an officer laying on his neck. The coroner said the opposite. He was hurt inside the van. There's this real divide over what people believe really happened. That's the point of volatility, I think.
Given the comments of the judge, it seems as though the prosecutors had a very, very high bar to prove intent, that the officers pretty much got up that morning with the intent of killing someone. And there's almost no way to prove something like that.
Well, I think the larger issue here in these trials has to do with changing the nature of police behavior, how we police, what public safety means. And I think that's the real issue at the bottom of all this. It's impossible to prove that someone woke up this morning, oh, I'm going to go kill somebody like Freddie Gray today. That's my idea. That's what I want to do. But what it has to do is with a report that community groups have put out earlier, a fascinating report, that showed that when they interviewed over 500 people in the community, they reported either physical or verbal abuse by police officers. There's a real divide here.
If there's a culture in a police department where people are viewed differently or viewed as not full citizens, as a threat, as people to be herded around, as was the case in Chicago by the federal report that looked at what went on in Chicago, as was the case in Ferguson, when the question of sort of racial discrimination and, you know, looking upon potential defendants as less than whites. If that's going on in a police department, aren't you already predisposed to have a certain kind of intent?
Absolutely. And I think that's what I'm saying is the issue here. The problem is that it's a very difficult legal point to prove. So it becomes
I get that. But then the issue becomes you can never prove that. So you're never really getting at the actual issue that causes these communities to have so many problems.
Exactly. And so what that means is this issue gets resolved outside of the courts. It gets resolved by pushing for change inside of city government and with the police department and how people are trained and the relationship between the police and the community. It gets resolved by people being more creative in terms of what we mean by public safety.
But it's conceivable that the community of Baltimore will go through all of these trials with small convictions or no convictions and have to hold tight until the community really gets around to, as you say, focusing on the real issue.
I think that's absolutely true.
That's hard.
It's going to be really hard. And as the summer months come through, and if more of the officers are acquitted, found not guilty, it could come very tense in the streets of Baltimore, really tense.
What are people saying on your show?
The community, especially in the African-American community, which is the majority community in Baltimore, the poor community in Baltimore, people are livid. They just feel a huge injustice is being done to them. And so the other part of it is, though, people are really organizing in communities to try to come up with a different model of how public safety should occur. And there's a 13-year-old boy who was shot by the police here in Baltimore last month. He was carrying a BB gun that looked like a real gun, and he had a basketball in his other hand. He saw the police, he ran. The police shot him. And so the community's response is, let's have a different sense of who patrols our streets. Some people want to have safe streets to the patrolling, which are the ex-felons who come out of prison, or the Nation of Islam, who might have approached this young man in a different way and been able to help the situation.
Mark Steiner, president and executive producer of the Center for Emerging Media and host of The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA-FM in Baltimore.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, funding research so patients do more than survive, they live their lives. Learn more at lls.org. Staples, offering printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals. At Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen. Support for The Takeaway's Community College Challenge is provided in part by the Joyce Foundation, working to improve quality of life, promote community vitality, and achieve a fair society.
Yes. Have you seen any caps and gowns on the streets? College commencement time, one small step for men and women, one giant leap into a job market full of baby steps, entry-level jobs with low salaries, and some very sobering realities for young people starting out. Some surveys say this is one of the worst job markets for college graduates in a decade or more. Stella and Charles Gutman Community College, part of the City University of New York, has focused its efforts on preparing their students for those realities in the Ethnographies of Work program. The two-part program helps students identify and explore areas of career interest in career areas where employers have an interest in hiring. Colin Akinora is a Gutman graduate majoring in finance at Baruch College. According to Colin, Gutman helped him find his way.
At the end of my first year at Gutman, I really, you know, needed to develop like a view of what I really wanted to pursue, who I wanted to be. I really wanted to know how an individual offer financial services to the client. So I wanted to investigate the culture of a bank. So when I took my Ethnographies of Work 2 course, I was challenged to do an interview with a banker in the bank. And, you know, it was really a great experience for me. I asked, you know, how does one, you know, solve financial problems for clients? You know, how do you, you know, sell financial products? Just the opportunity to really develop adequate knowledge to provide a service for, you know, helping clients achieve their financial goal. That was really what stood out to me the most when I did the interview.
What was your confidence about what your opportunities were when you left high school? And what was your sense of confidence and possibilities after you left Gutman?
Well, I knew that if I'm in an environment where I could have a supportive group of people behind me supporting my goals and aspirations, then I could definitely, you know, succeed in my endeavors. And at Guttman, I was really surrounded with student success advocates, which are counselors that really guides the students to academic success throughout their first 2 years at Guttman. And that increased my confidence a great deal.
When did you decide to enroll at Baruch?
Well, at the end of my second year, I knew that I saw Baruch as a very prestigious, you know, university that is known for competitive, you know, majors like finance, business majors and the like. So I saw that Baruch would be the best choice for me.
What about the job market? Does it scare you?
Not at all. I mean, considering how the market would demand a finance, you know, major, I was confident that I would be able to land a job in that field. What really interests me is just the opportunity to be in a business-like atmosphere environment. I really want to get into helping members of my community develop financial security for their future. That's something that, coming from a lower middle-class family, you know, I really wanted to, you know, be in a position to help not only myself but members of my community develop a financial future.
What is your community? What do you think of as your community here in New York?
People who work and strive to achieve a common goal, I would say, is, you know, my community. I'm from Brooklyn, New York, Canarsie, New York, particular.
What's the toughest challenge at Baruch, and how did Guttman prepare you for it?
Well, toughest challenge is to really manage your time. Throughout the course, I mean, throughout the semester, rather, you're faced with so many challenges that would, you know, many courses are very demanding, and you have to really develop a skill to find time to, you know, attend to each course in an effective way.
Did it help you set your priorities?
Yeah, I mean, thinking back to the support group that I had at Guttman, the SSAs, the Student Success Advocates, rather, they really provided me with time management skills and how to develop them, you know, to really thrive despite the challenges that I have.
You had to learn how to, no Game of Thrones tonight, no NBA Finals tonight.
Right, because at the end of the day, you know, this is a priority. You know, attaining a college degree is a priority and a privilege for many.
How do you think your community college experience reflects the community wanting to improve people? In other words, neighbors working together. There's something about Guttman that's, you know, it's an institution, but it's also, it's like people you know.
It's a very supportive community. The student body is very inclusive. When I think back to the first year at Guttman, it's cohort-based. We go through our first year, you know, in a cohort, in a house, and we take most of our courses together. Given that structure, that curriculum and structure within the college is truly, you know, helped me to develop lifelong relationships with the students and as well with the staff there at Guttman as well.
Do you think someone like you has a uphill battle to make it in New York because of your race or your background?
Well, I mean, it's always a challenge, you know. It's always a challenge being a man of color. But with hard work and dedication, I would definitely be able to thrive in the work economy.
Thanks, Colin.
Thank you for, you know, having me here to really reflect on my experience at Guttman.
Colin Ahankora, who graduated from Stella and Charles Guttman Community College with an associate's degree in business administration and is currently a senior at Baruch College with a major in finance. To hear more from our Community College Challenge series, just visit thetakeaway.org/communitycollege.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
It's very hard because there were a lot of people and people were screaming and, you know, that it couldn't happen at the Imperial.
There's no fading of memory for the people in Brownsville, Texas, about murders that took place on March 11th, 2013.
There's a lot of people, they go in that building and they don't respect it. I think it's time to the mayor to do something.
The murders of three little children. That report from CBS Channel 4 News in the Rio Grande Valley. Children killed by their parents who were, some people in town claimed, born of an evil folks in Brownsville still believe haunts the town, and especially the apartment building where the crimes were committed.
Brownsville is one of the poorest cities in the United States and has ranked several times as the poorest metro area in the United States. And I think in part because of that and because of its location on the U.S.-Mexico border, there's a sense that it's its own place, that it's not quite the United States and it's not quite Mexico. It's something else.
Laura Tillman found the ghosts of this crime as a reporter in Brownsville long after the murders. She says the way they affected this community's sense of itself says a lot about the places and communities left behind in America.
I came across the story of this two-story apartment building in downtown Brownsville that the city was debating whether or not should be demolished. It was the site of a horrible murder several years before in which a couple killed their three kids. And I realized when I started reporting on this story that there was so much more that people had to say, that it really hit on a lot of the issues that were going on in the city that were most important to people, issues like poverty and drug abuse and religion. You know, every time I would go to the building, people would approach me, they would talk to me, they would tell me their opinions.
Of the crime.
Of the crime, of why it happened, of what should be done with the building. And I just realized that if I really wanted to understand this new place, this was a story that would allow me to have those kinds of deep, revealing conversations with people about their beliefs and their hopes and their dreams and their fears that nothing else I'd reported on would give me access to.
And in some ways, the defendant in this case, the convicted father, is among the most famous people in Brownsville right now.
Right. He's, if you mention his name, John Alan Rubio, everyone knows the case immediately. Everyone seems to have some connection, even if it's very peripheral, to this family or to the building. And he was born and raised in Brownsville. I think there's a sense that he's of the city, even though he's become kind of a communal enemy there.
What was it about his family that was like Brownsville? What of his family was like nothing
right.
else that you saw?
He was raised in a family that struggled with, unfortunately, certain issues that a lot of people struggle with in Brownsville. His mother was a drug addict. His father was physically abusive. He struggled in school, and he didn't really have the support at home to try to get him the help that he needed to be more successful. When you look at IQ tests that were conducted when he was in school, he was on the low to average scale of IQ. By the time he was convicted of this crime, his IQ had dropped by about 20 points due to the amount of drugs that he was doing. I think that when people look at that family, they have a lot of sympathy for the things that that family was going through because they were just another family that people were friends with, people saw at the local soup kitchen, that didn't seem particularly different in the sense that they were facing different risks that other families were facing. And I think that maybe is why this crime in the end hit people so hard, because when you look at the conditions that that family was under, you realize there are so many other people in Brownsville who are still living like that.
You wouldn't have known about this crime if you hadn't come upon the debate over the demolition. Is that the case?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I had heard about this crime, but I never was interested in crime reporting particularly, and I definitely would not have written about this case if it weren't for the building.
What do you think the debate over the building signifies, and what was the building's fate?
The building in question where this crime occurred is a two-story apartment building in downtown Brownsville. Brownsville has an extraordinarily high number of historical buildings for Texas. It's the second highest number, I believe, in the state after
really?
San Antonio.
Really?
And actually, many of those buildings have been demolished over the years to make way for other construction. And so when this issue came to the Brownsville Heritage Council of whether or not the city could use public funds to demolish this building, and this was way back in 2008 when I first reported on this case, there was just one member of the Heritage Council, a man named Mark Clark, who voted against the demolition. And when I interviewed him, he asked, "Is there any such thing as an evil building?" I wasn't sure what that question meant exactly. And when I asked different people, there seemed to be like sharply divided opinions between whether the building itself was somehow haunted or evil or should be destroyed as a result of this case, or whether the building was simply a structure made of bricks and concrete and had no role in the crime. It was just a building.
What do you believe?
I think that ultimately the memory of this crime is contained inside of this building, and that it's a memory that is dredged up over and over again every time people see the building, every time people even drive through the neighborhood, because it's in a central location in the city. And because of that, I think that it has incredible power. Thinking about crimes like this in terms of words like evil or calling John a monster is damaging to our ability to deal with those crimes in a constructive way and deal with problems in the community that combined to allow something like this to happen. These structures where tragedies occur raise very complicated questions for communities. In the case of Brownsville, this conversation went on for a long time because of the building's historical status, because in order to use funding to tear it down, there had to be this debate. And in the meantime, there was a small group of people in Brownsville who started imagining, what could we do with this building that might actually speak to the causes of the crime? Could we make it into a social services agency? Could we make it into headquarters for the Wellness Coalition? And so in the end, there was a garden built behind the building called the Tres Angeles Community Garden in honor of the children. Sadly, when I went to Brownsville to see the demolition of the building, the garden was actually torn out of the property because in order to demolish the building, they had to make space. But the building is now gone.
Laura Telman is a journalist and author of The Long Shadow of Small Ghosts, Murder and Memory in an American City. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We want to leave you with one other little fact. Bob Dylan turns 75 years old today. Happy birthday to Bob Dylan. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
May your hands always be busy. May your feet always be swift. May you have a strong foundation when the winds of change shift. May your heart always be joyful. May your song always be sung.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.